Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriventfinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. This week, we asked our staff to answer this question. It's from a test the Federal Reserve uses to measure kids' financial knowledge. Here we go. If you have caused an accident, which type of vehicle insurance covers damage to your own car? Is it A, comprehensive, B, liability, C, term, or D, collision? Here's how the staff answered.
Liability.
Collision.
Collision? To my car?
Yes.
Of course liability is the other car.
Comprehensive. No way, it's collision.
To my car?
Mm-hmm.
Liability.
Collision?
I would say A, comprehensive.
I'm sorry, it's collision.
Good thing I haven't been in an accident recently.
There's more embarrassment to come as we financial experts test just how expert we really are. Play along with us on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. How confident are you in your financial literacy? Well, the Federal Reserve sent a quiz to high school students across the country. This year, they got less than 50% of the answers right. Let's see how much our friends at Marketplace know. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
So this financial literacy quiz from the Fed, you can find it on our website if you'd like to test your own FIQ. Meantime, we posed a few of the questions to our Marketplace colleagues this week.
Lisa Napoli?
Uh-oh.
would you like to answer a quiz question?
I'd love to answer a quiz question.
All right. If your credit card is stolen and the thief runs up a total debt of $1,000, but you notify the issuer of the card as soon as you discover it is missing, what is the maximum amount that you can be forced to pay according to federal law? Is it A, $500, B, $1,000, C, nothing, D, $50?
C, nothing. At least that's what I hope.
No, unfortunately, you will have to pay $50.
And why is that?
You'll have to ask Congress.
Okay, I'm going to call them right now.
Rico Galliano, he of Educating Rico.
Yes, I have a feeling that I'm about to be putting that education to the test, eh? Okay.
Are you ready?
No, but go ahead.
Sarah and Joshua just had a baby.
I love those guys.
They received money as baby gifts and want to put it away for the baby's education. Which of the following tends to have the highest growth over periods of time as long as 18 years? Is it A, a checking account, B, stocks, C, a U.S. government savings bond, or D, a savings account?
I would say either the bond or the stocks, but I'm going to go with stocks.
Yay!
That's not fair!
I am totally smarter than Lisa Napoli.
And we'll ambush a couple of other staffers as we go through the show. All right, the Fed isn't the only one issuing quizzes. You send them to us all the time. And one popular question we've been getting in the midst of the housing meltdown is this. How come private mortgage insurance isn't saving us from the subprime mess? If you have to get PMI in order to put less than 20% down, shouldn't all that insurance be kicking in? Well, we asked Marketplace's Jill Barchet to look into it.
Once upon a time, homebuyers who couldn't or didn't want to put 20% down had to buy private mortgage insurance. Lenders wanted protection against people walking away from properties they didn't have much equity in. So you'd think with all the 90%, even 100% home loans out there, that private mortgage insurers would be suffering and paying claims left and right. Jack Guttentag is professor of finance emeritus at the Wharton School of Business. He says mortgage insurers aren't in as much trouble as lenders are.
Not all loans are insured, and in particular, the loans with the highest rate of foreclosure, the subprime loans, a very large proportion of those did not carry mortgage insurance.
A lot of subprime lenders didn't care. but even regular borrowers could buy a house with little or no money down and avoid mortgage insurance. Banks were willing to issue them a piggyback loan for their down payment in lieu of insurance. Now mortgage lenders have to eat the losses on those uninsured loans themselves. Jeff Lubar of the Mortgage Insurance Companies of America says lenders are once again insisting that homebuyers take out private mortgage insurance.
We're writing about 40% more policies last month compared to the month before.
Insurers are even getting picky. They're demanding higher credit scores and raising premiums.
In certain markets where values are dropping, or what they call declining markets, more money up front might be required, more skin in the game, so to speak, 5% down, whereas before it might have been 3%.
For home buyers who are now being asked to pay for mortgage insurance, the experts say to take the cheapest one you can find. Professor Guttentag.
It's not you, it's the lender who's covered by insurance. And if the worst came to the worst and every mortgage insurance company folded its tent, it wouldn't have any impact on the individual borrower.
And since 2007, the insurance is tax deductible if you make less than $100,000 a year. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace Money.
By the way, there was more grim news from the mortgage mess this week. Pending home sales fell in February to their lowest level since 2001.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
I hope it is a surprise to no one that tax day is Tuesday, April 15th. If you've waited until the last minute to file, it's probably because you owe. But what happens if you can't pay the tab? Here with some answers is Andrea Coombs of DowJonesMarketWatch.com. And first, explain for us the difference between failure to file and failure to pay.
There's a big difference in terms of how it affects your wallet. So the IRS really frowns upon people who don't file a return. They really don't like that, and they will charge a hefty penalty if you don't file a return. It's 5% of your bill per month, up to a total of 25% of what you owe. Now, if you don't pay what you owe, then the penalty that you'll have to pay is 0.5% per month, up to 25% of your bill. So it accrues much slower. You're really much better off if you're afraid you're not going to be able to pay your tax bill. You're much better off going ahead and filing a return, letting the IRS know that, you know, you are there, you're on top of it, you're trying to do something, you're at least contacting them, and then start thinking about your payment options. And there are a few options out there.
Well, let's talk about those. You don't have the cash right now. What do? Put it on plastic?
That is one option. I hesitate to recommend using your credit cards, but it might be the lowest cost option for some people. It depends a lot on the fee. There's a fee to use a credit card to pay your IRS bill. You will pay a fee up to 3%. They call it a convenience fee.
They sound just like the credit card companies.
It's strangely similar, actually. Now, the IRS also offers payment plans. They charge an interest rate and they charge a fee, often, not always.
So this is kind of like an installment plan then.
Exactly. Now, the IRS offers one type of plan that's actually free in that there is no fee. You can apply online. You will owe penalties and interest. Right now, the IRS interest rate is 6%. That does change quarterly. But so it's, you know, 6% is not so bad if you're looking at a credit card rate of, you know, 13%. Again, it depends on what your situation is.
Okay, then let's go to the kind of worst case scenario. You do your taxes and you've made just a really, really bad error or decision or something like that, and you owe all kinds of money that you simply don't have. Does the IRS ever actually forgive any portion of what you owe?
They will forgive debt. It's getting harder to do this. There are two options. One is an offer and compromise or a partial payment installment plan. The partial payment installment plan, there's a form you can use. It's a lot more work in terms of just applying for it because you have to provide a lot more of your financial records. You have to sort of, you know, show the IRS your reasons that you cannot pay this bill. Maybe it's very steep medical costs or you just lost your job. The offer and compromise is valuable in that if you can get the IRS to agree to one with you, basically it's a new contract. Your old bill kind of falls away, and what you have is a specific dollar amount that you're going to pay, and interest and penalties aren't accruing over time. So it's beneficial to you, an offer and compromise. And it can happen. It's just pretty rare and getting a little bit harder to do, I have to say.
Andrea Coombs is a personal finance editor with DowJonesMarketWatch.com. You finished your taxes yet?
Not quite yet. This weekend, as a journalist, I work till deadline.
All right. Well, thanks for the help.
Thank you, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, oh, how the mighty have fallen. None other than former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan has really been taking it on the chin lately, has he not?
Boy, has he ever, Tess. I mean, do you remember when Greenspan was the greatest central banker in history?
And I note that you say the word was.
Was, because now he's being blamed for everything from, what, the housing bust, the credit crunch, even the recession.
He does seem to have a lot to answer for, though. He stepped down as Fed chairman in January of 2006. And within, what, a year or so, the credit crunch slams the financial markets and the economy?
Yeah, but in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Greenspan says, get this, he doesn't regret a single decision. That's a quote. Not many of us can say that.
Exactly.
But here's the straight story, Tess. Greenspan made mistakes, but he's no villain. You know, just as Greenspan worship went way too far, Greenspan bashing is far too nasty.
So why are these criticisms so intense these days?
Okay, there's one group of criticisms that I think is legitimate. It's talking about how do you run monetary policy. But there's another group of criticisms that bother me. And this is the story. Because of the way Greenspan ran monetary policy, we have all these problems. He had just done a better job. Nothing would be wrong. Because, hey, don't tell us that the private sector did anything bad or the private sector needs to be regulated. And don't tell me that it has to do with tax cuts and fiscal policy. It's just, well, the Fed, they've knocked their benchmark interest rate down to 1%. And if they'd only done it to 2 or 3%, we wouldn't have any of these problems today. Well, I think it's a very political statement. And it has to do with preserving tax cuts and trying to beat off regulation of the private sector.
But look, Chris, he did keep interest rates exceedingly low the whole time that the housing bubble was gathering momentum.
But the fear about deflation was real. Should he kept rates down for a year, or should he kept them down for, as he did, well over a year? Mm-hmm. Maybe there's 6 months where he was too loose. But you can't have a global collapse in credit and put it down to 6 months of monetary policy.
Yeah.
Way too much is being loaded on that decision.
Well, let me ask you about one other kind of infamous comment.
Sure.
I vividly remember him saying that more people should be getting adjustable rate mortgages. And of course, this was when interest rates were incredibly low, you know, down 1% basically. You know, at that time, people kind of went, really? Isn't that a little risky?
That was bad financial advice. It was terrible financial advice. And, you know, he's also wrong when he seemed to imply that he was supporting the Bush tax cuts. I mean, I think he was clearly wrong there. And where I do think the criticism of Greenspan is legitimate, I think he actually did a good job on the monetary side. But as a regulator, that's where he failed. And his belief that the financial services industry would regulate itself turned out not to be true. And Greenspan did not pay enough attention to what the financial services institutions were doing.
All right. Our own Chris Farrell with The Straight Story. And Chris, we'll check back with you in a bit for a little getting personal.
Thanks a lot.
Up next, I get my head examined.
What it tells us about your behavior is that when a bargain comes up, you're going to act on that bargain.
And maybe this guy should have his head examined, too.
Pretty girls like comics. Where were they when I was in high school?
A day in the work life of a geek. I mean, comic book store manager. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Drive south from Sacramento, where I met the Goslins, and you're in what's often referred to as America's salad bowl, mile after mile of verdant green farmland. It's also the epicenter of the housing mess. Stockton, California has the highest default rate in the nation. Keep heading down I-5 and you'll hit the town of Patterson, population 20,000. But despite its rural setting, it boasts the same kind of subdivisions you see in major metropolitan areas. And as of a couple of years ago, the same kind of prices.
Hey, Esme, you coming?
That's Dan Sinclair. He's a 43-year-old systems analyst who lives in Patterson with his wife Esmeralda and their three small children. We were heading out on a walk around his neighborhood. Dan wanted to show me just how many homes were for sale or simply abandoned.
All right, so here's a house you can see is in disrepair. I mean, it's not bad, but their lawn is not mowed. But that's one of the signs is when the lawn goes dead, you know that the people aren't living there anymore.
We only had to go three houses before finding another dried-up lawn with a sign that said bank owned. As we rounded a corner, the Sinclairs' neighbors got up from their front porch and asked what we were doing. Larry and Kathy Fiddler have lived here since the development went up 4 years ago.
That's a shadow of its former self, really. Everybody's gone, just about, but five of us.
What's happened to your home value?
It's gone down probably 35 or 40%.
Larry says they plan to stick around. He's confident new residents will move in as prices drop. For a while, he and Kathy mowed the lawns of nearby empty houses until there were too many.
Well, that one there is just recently, I think they vacated it.
Are these foreclosure here?
That one is, and...
This one next door is.
That one there. So, yeah, we're pretty much surrounded.
Becoming a little ghost town. A little ghost street.
We continued on to the next ghost street, where the Sinclair's house is. They've watched it all happen, and they might be next.
What's going on?
They bought their house 3 years ago. It's 3,600 square feet, including a four-car garage and a pool. Their purchase price, $440,000.
But the prices kept going up. At one time, our house was worth over $600,000. In fact, a model just like this, they were asking $699,000. And now things have entirely collapsed.
A similar house down the street is already in foreclosure, and the bank is entertaining offers for under $200,000. The Sinclairs stopped paying their mortgage in October, when the payment jumped from $3,000 a month to $4,000. Now they're basically squatting in their own home, living there for free. It's happening all over the country because mortgage companies and bankruptcy courts are so backlogged, nobody's sending the sheriff to kick people out. The Sinclairs say they never meant for this to happen, but Esmeralda lost her job and a third child was on the way.
And so we had to start making some hard choices, which included going into foreclosure on our house and kind of starting again. We're midway through the process. This is about a 6 to 8 month process, and we kind of have a plan of attack. Plan A doesn't work. We go to B, C, and D.
Plan A is asking the mortgage company to lower the principal they owe on the house, something Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke has suggested to the banking industry. Plan B, try for a short sale. Plan C, just walk away. Plan D, Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Many of the current government proposals call for reductions in interest rates. Dan says even that wouldn't be enough.
If they reduced our interest rate back to 4.25%, we might be able to make the payments, but I don't think we're going to.
Now, why not?
We would do it if the equity was there, but in a case where we're already so behind, imagine that for 5 years, say, we're going to pay $4,000 a month, and then we're just going to be back up at the what we bought the house for. Imagine how much we feel like we're throwing away money.
The Sinclairs say they want to take responsibility for their debts. But right now, it makes more financial sense not to.
I mean, you ask a good question is it really the right thing to do to let the mortgage companies take up the difference? That's a really tough ethical question.
Dan says he experienced the various stages of grief, including denial and anger. Now, he's just relieved.
We went through months of being skinflints because we knew we were going into the red. So we didn't buy anything. No. All of a sudden, we have a bank full of money, and we're living rent-free, but we know that's not really our money.
How does that feel?
Great. No. Not like he said. I mean, we were so tight with money.
It does feel great.
It does feel great.
Because all of a sudden, we feel like we have a little margin now where we can go out to dinner, get a babysitter.
But you're not paying your mortgage.
I know.
You're not paying the biggest obligation you have. That's how cool. Does that feel good?
we already went through the guilt. This is really what we need to do. Not what we want to do, but what we needed to do.
And they say they are paying a price. They're losing their home, most likely, and their credit is shot.
It's also our dream that's just not there anymore. Everybody dreams about owning a house, having a house, and now it's gone. And
but not everybody would think that they should get into a 3,000 square foot house.
Yes, you're right.
And that's taught as a lesson.
Their next home, the Sinclairs say, will be a much smaller one. We've got photos of the Sinclairs and all those for sale signs around their neighborhood on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same.
Economists describe the housing boom as yet another market mania, just like the dot-com frenzy. People's perceptions of the housing market reality were altered by everything from dinner party gossip to, yes, media hype. Jump in before it's too late. But some of the changes in homeowner psychology go beyond mania. There's a longer-term shift in how people think about their homes. And here to put us all on the couch is Chris Thornburg. He's an economist here in Los Angeles and has been watching the housing market for years. Chris, nice to see you again.
Absolutely great to be here.
You know, it seems like for time and memoriam, one of the big financial goals in life was to pay off your house, do whatever it took to get to that mortgage burning party. Would you agree that we, many of us at least, think of our mortgages differently now?
I think certainly so. I think we live in a much more sophisticated age. If you look back over time, for your vast majority of households, their primary asset was their house. Most economists today would say that if you actually paid off your house, you have a portfolio that's probably weighted too much towards your house. 50 years ago, it made more sense.
Is this a generational shift at all? Because I have to tell you, you know, when I got my first mortgage, the way I think about it, I really think about it as a monthly payment. I'm not planning to be in that house until I retire. I will probably move within the next 10 years. But my parents, I think, look at this and say, you're not planning to pay off your mortgage as quickly as you possibly can. When did that shift happen?
I have had this same conversation with my father. My father has paid off his mortgage. Half his assets are in his house. I said, that's crazy. He says, well, that's the way I like it. It is a different era. We are people who are less rooted to a particular place. I also think that in many ways, previous generations went through substantially more financial turmoil than I think our generation has experienced, at least up till now. But of course, what we're talking about here is because we move so much, we don't need to have a house paid off because, hey, we can get up and go anywhere we want. And in many ways, we live in a world where we have access to financial markets at the individual level. This isn't the realm of the elite anymore.
In that case, what's wrong with 100% financing, interest-only loans, in order to get you into that house?
The issue, of course, today, at the same time that we have unparalleled access to financial markets and ability to invest and buy stuff, we also have a situation where Americans don't save anymore. That kind of attitude is very, very problematic for the future of the U.S. economy. It's very sad that people seem to have lost the sense of the future. Maybe our confidence in the future is so great, we don't realize the kind of risk we're putting ourselves into.
Well, that was certainly the case when, you know, people were buying and getting homes based on the idea that the value would always go up.
Right. Why do I have to save anything when I can buy assets that only go up in value? Well, guess what? Home prices don't go up forever and ever. In fact, now we're going through the painful process of home prices coming down.
When we talk about the psychology of home ownership, you really have to address this idea of the American dream, and that a big part of that is owning a house. Should our notion of well-being be so tied to the idea of home ownership? Because it certainly isn't in other Western societies.
Absolutely not. Yet again, so much of the rhetoric going on out there in the context of the current crisis seems to be wrapped around this idea that, my God, we have to keep people in their homes no matter what. Home ownership is not the be-all and end-all. Home ownership is not the holy grail. There are plenty of people in plenty of circumstances for whom living in an apartment is a very logical thing to do.
Chris Thornburg is the founder of Beacon Economics here in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So Chris Thornburg says homeownership is not the holy grail. That may be, but it's awfully exciting. We bought our first home 4 years ago this month, and I remember sitting on the front steps, glass of champagne in hand, marveling at the idea that we owned this little slice of the planet. Amid all the gloom and doom of the housing crisis, we found one couple who will move this weekend into their new home in Santa Clarita, California. They're looking forward to stepping over their own threshold after living in a Burbank apartment since 2002.
The kitchen's tiny. It's really hot in the summer, really cold in the winter. Yeah, I seriously didn't think we could last here for 6 years. That's pretty amazing to me.
But we did. That shows that our marriage is.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Here's an alarming statistic for the financial well-being of Americans. The Bureau of Economic Advisors says we saved less than 1% of our incomes in 2007. But there is a tool some low-income people can use to help them save. Peter Granitz tells us about the Individual Development Account.
That's all you have, that Panasonic?
Far away from the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco's Mission District, it's difficult to walk a block without coming across a pawn shop or payday loan store. It's also the neighborhood Zanelio Roman lived in after emigrating from Nicaragua.
The gangs and the drugs and the alcohol and all that, I was like, no, I have to get my children out of here.
She's one of almost 60,000 Americans who've benefited from an individual development account. IDAs match the savings of debt-free low-income people with both federal dollars and private donations. Think of them as a 401k. Only IDA savers must use the money for college, a down payment on a home, or starting a small business. Ramon thought a home was the quickest way out of poverty and into a safer neighborhood. She was a 30-year-old sophomore in state college when she first learned about the program.
They had this banner that said, save money and we'll give you $2 for every dollar that you save. And that just got me to them, because I need money, right? Okay, so what do I have to do?
Nonprofits offer them, just like any bank would offer an account. Ben Mangan heads EARN, a San Francisco nonprofit. Like other IDA sponsors, his group defines assets as wealth or investments that stay for the long haul.
At the end of the day, what we offer has to be about someone's larger vision for themselves and their families.
Right now, there are more than 500 IDA programs across the country, but they don't just match anyone's money 2-to-1. To qualify, a person can't have any outstanding debt. That means a mortgage, credit card, even student loans. And that's not all. To qualify, you generally need to earn 100 to 200% of the federal poverty line. That's about $20,000 to $30,000 a year for a family of four. Carol Wayman is the legislative director for the advocacy group Corporation for Enterprise Development. She says the idea of IDAs has started to gain momentum in Washington, but the bureaucracy has yet to catch up.
And the way federal programs have been structured is if you're trying to save and you're receiving some kind of benefit like food stamps, you can get thrown off for saving.
We're going to get into the requirements. So you're all here to find out about what's required for you to withdraw.
Before opening their accounts, IDA savers need to attend financial education classes, like this one sponsored by EARN. These free classes range from daily budgeting to stocks and bonds and offer concepts people can use for a lifetime. Ben Mangan.
If you take the Starbucks example, and you get the largest latte they have, which is about $4 a pop, times 5, that's $20 a week, times 50, which equals $1,000 right there. That's $1,000 a year that someone could save if they made a different choice.
Roman, a married mother of two, was working her way through college when she took the required financial literacy classes. Then she realized she'd be smarter to pay off her last 2 years of college tuition with her IDA instead of buying a home. Her life's a bit different today. She earns money as a hospital researcher, a job she couldn't have dreamt of without a college degree.
And I just can't believe that. It's so amazing. In a year or two, your life just dramatically changes.
About half of the people who've had IDAs say this is the first bank account they've ever owned. As new immigrants, Ramon and her mother survived on about $60 a week. They couldn't afford to save, and school provided no guidance for Ramon.
I remember my ninth grade counselor and I went to see him, and I told him that I wanted to become a doctor. He laughed at me and he said to go find a man who can support me and have kids because I could never reach medical school.
She proved him wrong by getting into college and then tucking away $100 a month for tuition in her last 2 years. During that time, she saved $2,000 of her income. Thanks to that IDA, her $2,000 turned into $6,000, and her concern now is preparing for medical school entrance exams.
Actually, I want to go into research, and yeah, I want to work at a public clinic, you know, where they give free services, so I know I won't make enough money, but I just do it because I want to.
And Ramon continues to save, about 10% of each paycheck. That's about 10 times the national average. Mangan says Ramon's case demonstrates what IDA seek to do, let people choose their own path, and then pave it. In San Francisco, I'm Peter Granitz from Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
We're back again with Getting Personal. I'm Tessa Vigeland, and with me, as always, is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's just hit the phones again. Jeff is calling from San Diego, California. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
How you doing down there in San Diego?
Good. Hanging in there.
And what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I have, we have a four-month-old girl, and we're thinking about college funds. I've been asking around. 529 seems to be the most common answer. I was just wondering what other options we have, and if you prefer the 529s, what are the pros and cons, et cetera.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your new arrival.
Thanks.
And Chris, I think I'm going to do a mind meld with you and say, yes, you are going to recommend the 529.
I am going to recommend the 529 plan, and for a number of reasons. It's after-tax dollars, but your money compounds tax-deferred, and then when you withdraw it to pay for qualified educational expenses, tax-free. And California, for example, has a very good plan, and there's a number of choices that you can go with. The one that I'm most biased toward is what's called an age-based portfolio. So how old is your daughter now?
4 months.
4 months. So her portfolio would be almost 90% stocks. And then that gradually shrinks as she gets older and older, and it becomes more and more into what they call short-term fixed income securities, cash-like equivalents. I think it's a great way for people to save. But if you don't like that option, they have a number of other options ranging from 100% equity portfolios to money market mutual fund accounts.
Jeff, did you have any hesitation about doing a 529?
Well, yeah, with everything that's going on in the financial markets right now, I kind of hesitated. And I know the 529s work kind of like an IRA or 401k. I was curious if you could dictate what type of investments, you know, if we wanted to put it in something a little bit safer, you know, bonds or something, more of that kind of a leaning.
Chris, is a 529 plan kind of like a 401k or an IRA where you can pick your own investments?
Within the limited universe that is in the typical plan. So, for example, with the California, I believe they have their age-based portfolios, and then it's somewhere around 5 or 6 that you can do a custom strategy. So, for example, Jeff, you could do 100% into the money market mutual fund option just to be more cautious during this period of time. Depending on the 529 plan, if you buy them, like for example, from a brokerage house, they may open their whole universe of mutual funds. Some can be actively managed. They'll have those offerings in there. Some can be index funds, which, of course, as you know, I would smile benignly on the index fund option.
All right.
Well, good luck to you, and congratulations for thinking so far ahead for your little baby girl.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Well, if you need a lesson on investing, look no further. Visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Joseph writes in from Black Mountain, North Carolina. And he belongs to a social club, mostly for seniors, that meets pretty often. And apparently they invite various speakers to do presentations. At a recent meeting, they invited an investment advisor from UBS Financial Services. And they talked about, you know, all the benefits of doing business with UBS, of course. But a few days later, he saw a lot of negative news breaking about the company writing down $19 billion in losses. We remember this.
Oh, yeah. And that's on top of however many billion they wrote off before that.
Right. In the last quarter. So Joseph and the rest of the club members are now wondering how to react to this. Should they still consider UBS to manage their asset? And I suppose that this would be a question that you could ask about UBS. You could ask it about Citigroup. Yeah. You could ask it about just about any financial services firm right now.
That's right. And so part of it is, how safe is my money? That's really the question. And there I do think, go ahead and do business with UBS and all the other companies that you listed, because there are a fair amount of protections written into the system.
And you never know when the Fed is going to ride to the rescue, right?
Well,
like
with
Bear
UBS,
Stern?
Yes. I mean, it's a major global banking institution, for one thing. And yeah, that does provide a certain level of protection, just as you mentioned, not just the Fed, but central bankers of the world. And then there's also things such as SIPC, the Securities Investors Protection Corporation, provides a layer of insurance. And then companies like UBS typically have more insurance over that to protect their customers, people who do investing with them.
So is that somewhat analogous to the FDIC, where, you know, up to $100,000 in deposits is protected at a bank? That's the same sort of thing for a financial services firm?
It's not quite the same thing, because let's say you have $100,000 at a bank, mm-hmm, and you have $100,000 in the stock market.
Okay.
Now the bank goes under. You get your money. No questions about it. Your $100,000 in the stock market, because you're investment bank got into trouble, is now worth $50,000. All what the SIPC is saying is your account is safe. You still own those securities, but the difference is they don't protect the market value of that security. They protect your account, that it is yours, and you are not going to become a bankruptcy creditor.
Okay. And again, that goes for pretty much anywhere you're going to park your money, right?
That's right. So then you want to ask yourself the questions that we talk about all the time. Is this the type of service that you want? Do you need a full service broker? Do you want more of a discount broker or an online broker? But on the safety side of things, I'm reasonably confident, particularly now that the Federal Reserve has said we're underwriting the system.
All right. Well, Joseph, we hope that that helped out, and do say hello to all the club members for us. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for the great advice as always.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And our final installment of the Pop Quiz, brought to you by the Fed and our Marketplace colleagues, features producer Nancy Fargali. Chelsea worked her way through college, earning $15,000 per year. After graduation, her first job pays $30,000. The total dollar amount Chelsea will have to pay in federal income taxes in her new job will A, double, at least from when she was in college. And we'll note that Nancy is starting to scribble on a notepad. B, it will go up a little from when she was in college. C, stay the same as when she was in college. Or D, be lower than when she was in college.
Can I ask a few questions?
Okay.
Does she have student loan payments? Because that's going to...
That's not part of the question.
But that does factor into... So she made $15,000 when she was in college, mm-hmm, which meant she had no taxable income. And now she's going to make $30,000 outside of college. Why are you laughing at me? I take these questions seriously.
No surprise that Nancy outsmarted the Fed. The answer, by the way, was A. We have the entire financial literacy quiz on our website. It's marketplace.org. If Jonathan Clements took the Fed's quiz, no doubt he would ace it. The Wall Street Journal columnist has been writing about personal finance for the last decade and a half. But starting Monday, he's putting down his pen to become director of financial education for Citigroup. Jonathan Clements, before we say farewell, let's say hello and welcome to Marketplace Money.
Great to be with you, Tess.
You know, throughout the show today, we've been mentioning this quiz that the Federal Reserve gave to high school students across the country. And the bad news, of course, is that on average, they got less than 50% of it right. You've been writing about these things for years. And I'm curious, do you think most adults would do much better?
Unfortunately, I fear not. I mean, I do think the general level of financial literacy has increased over the past 20 years. I mean, people have basically been compelled to get more involved with their financial life just because of the disappearance of traditional company pensions and the emergence of these 401k plans where you have to decide how much to save and where to invest the cash. But still, even with that, I'd have to say, you know, the level of financial literacy in the U.S. is not great. And we have two pieces of proof of epic proportions. I mean, first we had the tech stock bubble and the subsequent collapse. And then more recently, we've had the real estate boom and the subsequent collapse. Clearly, people are not making entirely rational investment decisions.
Why do you think issues of personal finance are so difficult for many of us to grasp?
The investment problem is not difficult. You save regularly, you buy a diversified portfolio, you repeat as necessary. 30 years later, you retire with more money than you could possibly imagine. And yet, people cannot do it. I mean, we know that people make all kinds of behavioral mistakes. They're too short-sighted. They struggle with self-control. They don't save nearly enough. And I think a lot of it has to do with evolutionary psychology. We are the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of cavemen and women who were able to survive and reproduce because they focused relentlessly on the short term. You know, they weren't thinking about retiring 30 years hence. They were thinking about how they were going to survive until tomorrow.
You wrote 1,009 columns. Were there any trends in personal finance that surprised you either when they came along or when they went away?
One of the things that I tell people is there are basically only 20 personal finance stories, which means that I've written each of those stories 50 times each. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why I thought it was time to give it up. I mean, eventually, readers were bound to notice. In terms of trends, you know, what constitutes prudent investment advice has not changed over the past 13 and a half years. What you should have done in 1994 is the same thing you should be doing today in 2008. It's just that the markets change. You know, something gets hot. Everybody gets overly enthusiastic about it. This year, it's commodities. A couple of years ago, it was real estate. We get this continuous new scenario thrown up by the financial markets. We all get all hot and bothered about it. But what you should be doing stays the same. You should be saving regularly, putting money into that 401k. The answers don't change. It's just the scenarios that we're dealing with.
What's the reader reaction been to your departure?
I have had 1,800 emails in response to my last column in the first 24 hours after it appeared. I've started to go through them. There hasn't been one negative one so far. One of the things that's really interesting to me is that a lot of people feel like they know me personally. Over the years, I've written a lot about my two children, Henry and Han, mm-hmm. and about I've tried to teach them about money. And I think that's a big reason. People feel like, you know, they can relate to the struggles I've had trying to teach my kids about money. And so as a consequence, they feel like I'm a friend. And, you know, that's nice to know. I mean, it really has been very touching.
You're heading into a new job. You're leaving journalism entirely. And I'm sure you've given plenty of advice over the years in your columns about how to tell when you're ready for a new job. Tell us what a personal finance columnist does to prepare for a career change.
Well, I got to tell you, Tess, I knew that it was time to move on when people started referring to me as an institution. I got to tell you, there is not a single child in America who gets up in the morning and says, "Mom and Dad, when I grow up, I want to be an institution." Yes, it was time to move on. And, you know, I feel like this is really a good moment. I mean, I have written just over 1,000 columns. I've said pretty much everything I want to say. So better to quit when I'm at the top of my game. In terms of why I'm moving on, well, I think change is good. You know, at some point, you know, you need to have this sense of progress that we seem to love so much. And I'm hoping this change will give me that.
Well, Jonathan Clemens, good luck on your new endeavors. And thanks for coming in to chat with us. And thanks for all your advice and words of wisdom over the years. I think a lot of people, including myself, will miss them.
Sure thing, Tess. Happy to do it.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, New York City unveils its Office of Financial Empowerment.
For the first time, city government has taken in-house a mission that I think many people feel is reserved to the not-for-profit sector.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer.
To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.